Hi, welcome. Here is Hot off the Cloud from Cloudonaut. My name is Andreas.
And my name is Michael.
And this is our weekly show about basically all things AWS, the news from this week. It's about our lessons learned. And last but not least, it's about your questions. So if you're following this live, please use the chat to ask, send us your questions. We will try to answer them at the end of the show. But first of all, I think, Michael, we should start going over what happened this week on AWS, so going through the news. So I'm using an RSS feed reader to scroll through all the announcements from AWS, and actually I didn't mark too many of the items that came in this week with a star, which is basically my system of preparing for this show. But still, I got a few. So yeah, let's see what we can bring together here.
Yes, Andreas. So I think it's kind of clear that there is like preparation going on for reInvent. So we will see lots of announcements before and during reInvent. And now it's a little bit less than usual. But yeah, so let's dive into what we have, Andreas.
Yeah, absolutely. So I will start. So my first announcement from the past week is AWS Glue crawlers support incremental Amazon S3 crawling on existing Glue data catalog tables. So I didn't know about that feature, but I found it very interesting because so I've been using Glue crawlers from time to time to scan over data stored on S3 to prepare it basically for mainly for Athena. That's my main use case for it. And I used the crawling over a whole bucket or over a specific path in a bucket. But it sounded interesting to me that now you can use basically only scan the bucket when something changes and only scan through the files that actually changed since you scanned them the last time, which is probably important to reduce costs for all those list bucket calls and also going over a lot of data that you've already seen. So I played around with that little feature a little bit, and actually that's what I like about preparing for this show, because it makes sure that I'm going into those features and playing around with them a little. So actually what you need to set up is you need to set up S3 event notifications for the buckets that you're interested in. And then you set up an SQS queue as well. So basically you make sure that these S3 events getting stored in an SQS queue. And then you configure the Glue crawler, and basically you have an option there, scan on demand, or not on demand, but scan only what has changed, only the changes that happened in the S3 bucket. And I thought, so my when I tried the feature without reading through the documentation in very detail, my idea was whenever a new event gets uploaded, it will just spin up the crawler and make sure that this gets added. But that's not the case. So what happens is you configure the Glue crawler, runs on a schedule. And what the Glue crawler is then doing when you enable this new feature, it basically reads all the events from the SQS queue, which all the changes to your S3 objects, and then only scans through those. So that's what happens. It makes sense probably to not do that on every change, because you need to spin up the Glue crawler and everything, and you pay for that and stuff per minute. So it makes sense to batch basically the incoming files and then go over that list. And SQS makes a lot of sense for that as well, because it's a durable queue. Yeah. So so in my very simple test with a few CSV files, this worked very well. And
yeah, sorry, I have one question. Is like the SQS queue, is that owned by me, or is it like a Glue queue that I configure?
Yeah, it's owned by yourself. So you configure that. You can also configure a dead letter queue. It also does not... this is just owned by you, and you have to make sure that the queue policy and the IAM policy for the crawler fit perfectly fine. So yeah, that's a little Abramo. Okay. It would be cool if it just happens out of the box, but yeah, still a nice feature.
All right. So the next news item that we are going to talk about is a change or an addition, a little feature to AWS Lambda. So what AWS Lambda did since a couple of, I don't know if it's months or years, but basically what you can do is you can collect Lambda to different to different event sources, for example, Kinesis Stream, SQS Queue, and so on and so forth. And what you can do since quite some time is you can filter those events. You can, and the way this works is that if you are familiar with EventBridge, like the rule syntax, that is using the exact same syntax, so you can kind of filter and only invoke the function if the incoming event matches the filter. And that was available for a couple of input sources. And what changed last week is that this now works for Kafka sources, and this includes the managed Kafka from AWS, and it also includes self-managed Kafka, so you can hook up Lambda to a self-managed Kafka cluster. And the second addition is it now works for Amazon MQ. So Amazon MQ is kind of the RDS for queuing systems, so it supports ActiveMQ and RabbitMQ at the moment. So for those kinds of systems, you can now also use the filtering technique. And one of the biggest benefits why you might want to use this is that it is basically free of charge. So the filtering is free. So if you, in your Lambda function at the moment, do a lot of filtering for yourself, then this might be a way to reduce your Lambda costs and also maybe simplify your code a little bit. On the other side, it also makes testing a little bit harder, but that's kind of the trade-off here. So I learned two interesting things, Andreas, by looking at this news item a little bit in more detail. The first thing that I was kind of, or what is a little bit problematic, is that when you make a change to this filter configuration, then the documentation says that it can take up to 15 minutes to apply your filtering rules. So when you are developing and something is not working, you make a change, and then it's kind of with IAM policy, so you don't really know when it is active. So you have to be very, very, very patient when you develop those kind of things, because you don't really know when the rule that you are seeing is actually the one that is applied in the real world. So that's a little bit problematic, I think. Not sure if that is a big problem, but it is at least mentioned in the docs. And the other thing that I like is, or the concept that you have to keep in mind is, and this is the same for SQS messages, when you receive a message that does not match the filter, the Lambda system or runtime, whatever, will acknowledge the message as processed. So in Amazon MQ, it acknowledges the message. So this is a like simple or very similar to SQS. And in Kafka, it commits the offset for the message. It also kind of, in the end, it marks the message as processed. For messages that match the filter, it will only acknowledge them if the Lambda function invocation is successful. So it waits for, it's basically a synchronous invocation, and then it acknowledges the message. So that's something to keep in mind, just to understand how everything works. And that's all I have to say about this new feature.
Cool, very interesting. I didn't look into all those integrations yet, but it sounds very interesting and also good thing to have those options. Really a lot of options, actually. Even self-managed Kafka. This is nothing I would expect from Lambda. Yeah, very cool. The next item that got my attention is Amazon EC2 adds service quotas for Amazon machine images. I think that is a very uncommon announcement from AWS, that they are adding a new quota for something that has been around. But yeah, here it is. So I think the most important thing to notice here is that there is now a maximum number of public AMIs allowed in the region per account, and this is 5. So you cannot publish more than 5 AMIs publicly per region. There are also 2 other quotas. One is the maximum number of entities that you can share an AMI with is 1,000. And the maximum number of public and private AMIs per region is 50,000. So that's probably unlikely to, or some might happen to hit this quota, but most probably don't. I think I'm not sure what these quotas are about. Probably some of them are from a cost perspective to avoid huge spending because of some misconfiguration. The other with the maximum number of public AMIs might be to make sure that no one is just, I don't know, making AMIs public to share them with other accounts they own themselves, and to make sure that they have a look into that with AWS support when requesting a quota increase, maybe. No matter, all those three quotas can be increased, so they are all adjustable. You can open a request for that and get those limits increased.
Okay, Andreas, I see. So the next item that I picked is a change to Athena. So that's the service that can, for example, query your S3 bucket using SQL as the query language. And there is the announcement is there is now a new engine available, a new query engine. It's version 3. And I think by default, most of us will run still on version 2. So the way Athena works is there's something called, I think it's called a workgroup or workspace. I'm not 100% sure about that. I think it's workgroup. And they are configured by default that Athena decides when they upgrade to the new version. And so all my accounts that I checked were still on version 2, but you can manually set this to version 3. And the question is now, why should you do that, right? So I mean, what are the benefits? So let me quickly talk about the benefits. And so what AWS has is there are 50 new SQL functions and 30 new features. I kind of looked through all these changes, so they are documented in kind of a release note document. And I don't think there's anything that is really significant for lots of people. I mean, there are lots of niche stuff that it was added, and I think a couple of people are very happy about that. But I was not kind of like seeing something that's so important that I want to share it here. But keep in mind there are some new features, so that's always great. New possibilities. The thing that kind of catched me was that they also mentioned that there is a query performance improvement. And actually the claim was that the query performance is quite high. So the blog post is using some standardized, like for database workloads and stuff, they have so standardized tests, standardized data sets where they run some queries and then they measure that. And this was really significant improvements in performance. I don't really remember the numbers, but it was significant. And so I tried to do this with a couple of queries that we use. So for example, we have CloudFront access logs. We have, what else do we have? S3 access logs. We also have some like reports from AWS Marketplace. So we have like medium volume data and also very low volume data. Usually this is CSV files or something like that. So I executed the query. I changed the version and I executed the query again. And I was like, my expectation was that this is now a little bit faster. So it turns out all of my queries were actually slower. So 10 to 20% slower. So I was not able to perform any query that was faster. I don't know if that's because of the data set size. So I was not able to run a query that really was in the terabyte range, because I like all my queries are kind of, they narrow down the data set so much that it's gigabytes in the end. And so I don't know if this really, the change only is significant if you have lots of data that Athena has to process. I don't know. Maybe that's the reason. But if anyone kind of experiences a significant performance improvement, feel free to share that with us. And also maybe some details about the data set and the query that you run that would be of interest to me, at least. So yeah, that's it. Athena, a new version. You can enable it if you wish. Otherwise, AWS will at some point in time upgrade you automatically. I don't see any, like there was no kind of deprecation warnings or some incompatibility in the documentation, so I don't expect any problems by switching over to version 3. But yeah, that's it. Andreas,
AWS announced a new Cost Explorer console experience. So I looked into that. So a new experience sounded great. So I expected a lot from the Cost Explorer experience. And so actually, as it turns out, at least I could not find any new features in the Cost Explorer. So it seems to be exactly the same feature set, so exactly the same graph, exactly the same table. I think the experience that changed is that they are using their new UI kit to build this part of the management console. So basically, it looks like all those new UI interfaces that AWS announced over the past month. So nothing too fancy. Let's have a short break from all those AWS news. And in case you're looking for a new job, you should pay especially attention to the following offerings, because as we all know, AWS expertise is in high demand, and we will share two open positions from our partners. Our partner Demicon is hiring a senior full stack developer. So besides AWS, your favorite tech stack should include things like JavaScript or TypeScript, Angular or React for the front end, and Node.js or Golang for the back end. So if you are really into building applications on AWS as a full stack developer, and you also want to lead other developers doing so, check out Demicon, which is a first remote-first company hiring within Europe. You'll find all the details in the show notes, find a link to the job description there as well, of course. And then our partner TechRacer is hiring a cloud consultant focusing on AWS migrations. So basically, that role includes things like planning a migration, change management, working, of course, very tightly with the customer, but also bringing in a team of experts, basically managing a cloud center of excellence to make sure that the migration is a success, which means from a technical perspective, of course, but also from a business perspective. So things like, bringing on the business case for that, communicating that with everyone in the organization. So if you're into that, if you find those migration projects and change management project interesting, check out this open position. TechRacer has offices in Hanover, Duisburg, Frankfurt, Hamburg, Munich, Vienna, Lisbon, and Lucerne. And so check out TechRacer and this open position as a cloud consultant focusing on AWS migrations. So Michael, did you learn anything that is worth sharing in the past week?
Yes, I think so. So what I think I complained about this, and you also complained about this in the past on Twitter, that we have a couple of code pipelines that are actually super slow. So it feels very slow compared to other technologies that are available these days. And so what we did, or what I did for a client actually this or last week, is that we migrated a pipeline from Code Pipeline over to GitHub Actions. And it is really impressive how much faster it runs. So what does the pipeline do? It deploys a lot of CloudFormation stacks. And most of the time, none of those stacks is changing. So it basically is just an update without any changes. And it turns out that in Code Pipeline, every CloudFormation update action that is implemented needs at least 5 to 10 seconds to execute. And in GitHub Actions, it's 1 to 2 seconds. So this is like significantly faster. And it really, you can feel that. So it runs significantly faster. And I think that's really something to keep in mind. And I think we definitely should rework our pipelines as well, because it's really frustrating and it really slows you down if you have to wait for the pipeline to finish. And it really, it takes a lot of time to do more or less nothing. And it even gets worse if it starts code pipeline actions, because code build actions, because code build takes so long to start up actually to do something. But yeah, in this case, it was just CloudFormation stack deployments, but it still, it runs so much faster. Even though it like code pipeline does some parallelization, And GitHub Actions doesn't, or at least the way that I implemented it, and it's still faster in the end. So yeah, that was my lesson learned. So it is, I think, beneficial to do the migration, and also like the integration with GitHub, the OpenID Connect integration, to kind of provide or like get rid of the IAM users that you needed before that, and where you also have to rotate the credentials manually and all that stuff. So that's gone. It's not needed anymore. You just set up OpenID Connect and OpenID Connect provider in AWS IAM, and you trust the GitHub kind of implementation, and then you have access to your AWS account from a GitHub Action with temporary credentials. So that's really cool. It really works very seamlessly. So there's no problems here. It really worked. It worked the first time. So I pushed to my GitHub repository and it just worked. So that was great. And actually in GitHub Actions, what I also learned is that you can reuse workflows. So you can have a workflow that calls another workflow and have parameterization. So in CodePipeline, I always write all my, like if I have a def and a prod stage, this is more or less a copy, like def is a copy of prod or the other way around. I just switch some names. And with GitHub Actions, that's not needed because you can have one flow that deploys everything with one input parameter that's called stage name or something. And then it just is like a single change. Like if you make a new CloudFormation template, add this in a single place, and it works in both def and prod. So that's really cool. So it's faster and it's easier to reuse. It also like user experience integrated in GitHub. It's everything is really nice looking and you see where the problems are. That's my lesson learned. So probably CodePipeline is on hold now. So we will probably use more of GitHub Actions.
So I've been working in a project where we also migrated from CodePipeline to GitHub Actions. And I think, I've heard about others doing the same right now, so I think the trend is definitely with this new OpenID Connect, or not so new, but still newish feature to move away from CodePipeline and go with GitHub Actions. Okay, so Hot of the Cloud is also about your questions. So you can send us your questions either on the live stream by using the chat, or you can also send us a message through the week. The hashtag AskCloudOnOut is perfect for that, or send us a direct message or what have you. And we will be happy to answer your question. So we have one question in the chat from CloudServer22, and the question is, does the CloudFormation book in your example in your book autoscale Fargate based on SQS events?
We don't really have a Fargate example that consumes from SQS, Andreas. No. Can you remember one?
We don't.
So I think it's EC2 based.
Yeah. We have one with EC2. And so with the new chapter 18 in the book in AWS in Action, is about running containers on AWS. And we introduce an app runner there, and very, very briefly. And the other one that we go into is basically how to build a cloud native application with ECS, Fargate, and S3. And the application that the example in there is basically a note taking app, and it runs on Fargate, just a container, spins up a container on Fargate, and which presents a web interface. And in the data layer is basically an S3 bucket. So there's no SQS involved in our container example in the book. It presents the standard certificate for the Amazon AWS domain name. So the workaround that I'm aware of is that you place an NLB in front of the VPC endpoint. So basically, the NLB just forwards the incoming traffic to the network interfaces of the VPC endpoint for API gateway. And by doing so, you basically use the NLB you configure your certificate at the NLB. And that means that now your custom domain name with your own certificate works with a private API gateway. So basically, one more time, the flow is the request comes in, it goes through the NLB, which has a target group which points to the VPC endpoint, two or more private IP addresses. And the VPC endpoint basically forwards then, distributes the request to your API gateway which only accepts requests from this single VPC endpoint. So that's basically how you build a private API gateway with a custom domain name. Cool.
All right.
Thank you for asking your questions. So if you have any follow-up questions or other questions, let us know. Happy to answer them next week. So this is Hot off the Cloud for today. We will be back next week with the latest AWS news, our lessons learned, and your questions. Have a great day. Bye.
Bye.